Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 82, a special episode featuring a professional development workshop called Forgotten Women of Organizational Scholarship, which took place at the 2021 annual meeting of the Academy of Management. This is part two of the episode, where we present the following speakers: Maya Koritsa, which will be talking about the work of Rosemary Stewart; Maria José Tonelli, which will be talking about the work of Isabel Menzies Leith; and Lisa Cohen, which will be talking about the work of Rosabeth Moss Cantor. If you missed part one or wish to learn more about the event, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So we're going to move straight away to Maya Koritsa presentation. And Maya is an associate professor of organization and management at Warwick Business School. Her work focuses on corporate governance, accountability, responsibility, and executive management and leadership in practice. In her research about the daily work of chief executives, she has championed Rosemary Stewart's work about the reality of what managers really do. And she will talk to us exactly about the work of Rosemary today. Over to you.
Thank you very much to Pedro and Greta for this great honor to be here and present Rosemary's work. I am actually going to suggest that, unlike the previous three great women and their work, I believe that Rosemary Stewart is actually genuinely overlooked and underknown. And so it's a great privilege to be doing this, especially because I actually got to meet Rosemary just before her death in 2015, when she was 90 years old, she died. And she was kind enough to look at a paper that Davide Nicolini and I were developing, and she was still working until the very end. And so I think she deserves so much more attention, and I want to talk about her today. So I'm going to try and keep it brief. On that note, I want to just start with a few speculations as to why perhaps some people might not be as aware of her as perhaps they are all the other women who are included in our discussions today. Loewe in 2013 and the one special issue on Rosemary's work in leadership quarterly suggested a number of reasons. He highlighted effects of time on the ardor of particular body of research. In this particular case of managerial work and managerial roles, which have sort of waned really from attention, though I know colleagues like Zahira who are here are kind of trying to really ump that up again, and she does wonderful work. Also, there's a kind of regiocentric crowding out effect in terms of research agendas appearing. So just to give one example, for instance, I'll talk about that in a second, but Rosemary's work, first book appeared on managers and managerial work, appeared in 1963, so 10 years before Mintzberg's The Nature of Managerial Work. And yet, I just had a quick look when preparing this week, and Mintzberg's book has been cited 14,000 times plus, of which 202 times in 2021 alone. Whereas Contrast in Management, which is the book that Rosemary has most been cited, has been cited only 476 times, of which five times in 2021, of which two are by Davide Nicolini and I in various versions of our paper. So I think I'm really speaking here as one of the converted. But I think finally, she really was very much until the very end insisting on centering managers and managerial work in her research, rather than choosing to really describe what she was doing as leadership, even though in the ensuing years, it was the latter that really became the faddish, if you would, focus of a lot of our research. So there's a number of reasons really why Stewart was overlooked. So I think I'll start just really to give you a sense of who she is. She authored 15 plus what she called readable and useful books. And I think this is important about her. She was very much interested in the notion of better management, in researching management as a scholarly endeavor, trying to understand through various multimodal methods basically what the reality of managerial jobs were like. And for her, we would today describe her as an early champion of really evidence-based management. She wanted managers not to rely on fads and fashions, but to rely on people carefully looking and comparing their work and effort with comparable or non-comparable others to try and determine how this important work, which is still done by many and impacts many, many more, could be done better. And so really that kind of better management was what really passionately drove her efforts. As she often said, knowing managerial jobs better improved choices. And this is particularly important for managers because most of the time they remain entirely ignorant of the choices that they are actually making in their daily work. And that actually is important. And a final point that she highlights in an essay that she did in the 2003 special issue as to why she is overlooked is that for much of her career, much like many of the women we've talked about, but really she was writing in the sort of 60s and 70s and 80s. As she says, she was very much gatecrashing a man's world. This is what one of her male colleagues called it, used this phrase. And she acknowledged there were some advantages to being a woman. She was talked at a lot, which helped when interviewing and gaining access. But also at the same time, there was a great skepticism there that, as she says, a woman could have anything useful to say about management. And I think for many of us who continue to step into some classrooms, that continues to unfortunately be a challenge. But I think in her case, it very much was part of the reason why we don't hear about her and why she wasn't picked up as much as somebody who had a body of work around her and a school around her. So some key concerns that drove her research, really, how much has management really changed? She was highly skeptical about the recycling of ideas that we continue to do in management, really talking about that if you observe managers, some of the basics of managing itself, not necessarily managerial jobs, continue to be pretty much available and similar. We may just name them different things. That being said, unlike Mintzberg, who really in his early work on roles, managerial roles, was concerned with kind of similarities, really her primary driver and interest was in differences in jobs. And this was particularly also in her recognition that management was contextual and historical. And in that, I think she really is deserves a lot more credit, I think, as an early kind of recognizer of what we might call as contingency realizations. So she studied everything from middle managers to top managers. She studied public and private managers. She studied various contexts in various industries. And she also taught continuously and actively at the Oxford Centre for Management. So she not just did research, but did training and then research at the same time. So there was a constant contact with practice. And she was also very careful to say, even though she had great respect for colleagues like Mintzberg, that US-centric insights on management are not universal. And there was a danger in necessarily taking them, particularly if you focus on similarities in management, as indeed universal. So as she says, you know, there were really no easy answers in her work, and she stresses this continually. We should be skeptical of general prescriptions. We should be skeptical of the idea that somehow success can be reached through the same means. And for those of us who exist in executive spaces and sort of practice spaces, this is a very useful reminder. And so instead, what she did is she developed what I think, and I genuinely was writing a paper and refining a paper today by using this this framework, is she develops a sort of triad of how we can understand individual jobs and how they're enacted in everyday practice by basically developing this notion of demands, constraints, and choices. And as she said, in this is a 1980s book in which she studied new managers in the National Health Service in the UK, the extent and nature of managerial choices are determined by the space. So there's a wonderful kind of a spatial connection there, all left by demands and constraints. So job will differ how much you have to necessarily spend on certain aspects, which are the demands. They're also differ in terms of the kind of constraints that you might have. So the expectations that others placed on you, which might not be formalized. And both of these will vary over time and affect choices. And so really what that then leaves, and I think is another really nice analytical concept that hasn't been picked up very much, is this notion of domain. So this is the area where the manager acts as if he, this is the time, has a responsibility. And not for the lack of trying, by the way, she did try to interview and engage more female managers, but unfortunately continue to be a man's world. And part of the reason why this was also important for her is another key question in her work was, to what extent are managers carried by momentum? Oftentimes, particularly Mintzberg in the early work, would describe them as very much kind of reactive mode constantly. And she kind of said, actually, that's not necessarily true, because if we look at demands, constraints, and choices, we actually appreciate that these are not fixed. So there's a capacity to change these, including via what she called expectation enactment. And this was simply her word for the ability for managers to craft differences, to modify their conditions, to modify the constraints that they face, the type of choices that they face, and therefore modify the expectations of their role that people who are shaping their role have, and therefore influence how that can be done. So there's an agentic kind of a view here. And other things that also account for differences, we often talk about, for those of our empirical researchers, we often look at levels in comparison against levels or functions. She really developed this body of work much more in a really wonderful way. So for instance, the nature of contacts accounts for difference. If you're mostly working with peers, or if you're working mostly solo, or if you're kind of hub and spoke everywhere contacts. Similarly, type of work pattern, are you coping with sudden problems or is it a lot of recurrent work? What's your degree of choice and duration of activities? Relationship with a boss, demands of private life, degree of exposure, all of these things were really there for Rosemary as ways for people to understand other jobs, including their existing one, including potential ones, and then also allow people to make better choices. And that's the important thing for them there. And so summarizing research questions that I want to highlight that I genuinely think for those of us who are maybe after this looking at this and thinking, how can I use this? What's the nature of managerial agency, or indeed agency of actors who we might see as, quote, leaders or managers? She really didn't abide by that distinction, by the way. How does this change with time and context? What consequences do various choices that individual managers have on the nature of their work, but also wider outcomes for others? How do perceptions matter, both of individual managers of their own work and of others on their work and vice versa? What drives particular choices and the emphasis that people make? So Mintzberg, for instance, talks about style, but style itself has this kind of sense of sedentary nature, as if you have a particular style and you have to change it. I think the focus on choices and the focus on emphasis really opens up this kind of constant agentic effort that managers can make. And finally, to what extent can organizational design support particular kinds of choices made by managers? And as I said, throughout Rosemary, she remained active with managers, active particularly in the National Health Service in the UK, really convening monthly meetings of chairs and CEOs, again, really driven by this idea of better management. So I also thought I would include how some of her work might help, perhaps in a teaching setting or a kind of executive teaching setting, managers and leaders be what she called analytically proactive. And I think it's a wonderful depiction, really, of what ideally we would want people in those roles to be. We would want them to consider and reflect on their own practices, to analyze them in a way that allows for comparability and conversation, and then use that as a driver to basically make meaningful changes and better choices, really, she would say. So you can use the demands, constraints, and choices as a sort of reflective tool, starting with an individual guided reflection. What are these for you? How do you see them? How do you perceive them? And then allowing a collective discussion to basically identify opportunities for choice, redefinition, and learning. Similarly, what's your agenda? And I think this is a wonderful thing that she also highlighted. You know, how can you square your agenda with the kind of constraints and choices that you have? And obviously, she also highlighted political behavior, importantly, as being very important in certain kinds of jobs, depending on the nature of relationships. I'm going to stop here now. If you're interested at all in this, this is just some of the overview of the kind of topics that you might want to be interested in and the work that she's done. But she's really very worthwhile checking out. And please let me know if you'd like to talk about it further.
Thank you, Maya, very much. Great applause for you. We put in the forgotten in brackets because I think some of these women are more or less known in our community, and Rosemary is certainly an example of one that deserves to be read and cited more. And by the way, we have an episode in the podcast about her with Maya herself talking about that. But let's move to the next one because we are a bit running behind. The next speaker we have is Maria José Tonelli. that is professor of management at FGV in São Paulo. Her work focuses on understanding gender issues in organizations and the sociology of management knowledge, including the role of colonial gender relations. At her home university, she teaches and defends the importance of her course on organizational theory classics. And Maria will talk about the work of Isabel Menzies-Leith today. Thank you, Maria.
Hi, I'd like to warmly thank you, Pedro and Greta, to organize this PDW. And it's a pleasure to be here learning for the presentation of the previous presenter, this wonderful woman. And I'm talking about Isabel Menzies, an English psychoanalyst, I think, and she played a central role in the creation of the Tavistock Institute. And at that time, she developed an innovative idea for the comprehension of individuals, groups, and organization. A little about her trajectory, mentors, influence, and main contributions, and some fine comments. First of all, she was born in 1917 in Scotland. She went to the school in the region. And in 1935, she was at the St. Andrew University. And in 1939, she received her degree in economics and experimental psychology. At that time, Eric Trist was her professor, and he has he had an important role on his future jobs and also in the partnership that they have to create the Tavistock Institute. So she was a lecturer for a while, and then she worked, invited by and recommended by Eric Trist to the British Army during the war. And in 1946, she was at the pioneer group that created the Tavistock Institute. And she was the only woman at that time in this group. In 1954, she was qualified as a psychoanalyst, and 1957, she was qualified as an analyst as well. So, as a child analyst. And from the 60s on, she was mentoring analysts at the Institute of Psychoanalysis in London. In 1975, she moved to Oxford. And then I think she lost ties with the Tavistock Institute as well with the Institute of Psychoanalysis in London. And she worked there in Oxford as a psychoanalyst in a private clinic. And also, she continued her activities as a consultant, but she lost her connections with the Tavistock. She received a doctorate from the University of London, and she died at the age of the 90s in 2008. Already retired, she continued to offer clinic supervision. Her mentors, Eric Trist, for sure, because he was her professor. He recommended her for many jobs, and they were also a colleague for creating the Tavistock Institute. Melanie Klein was also an important mentor for her because it was her first analyst, and had a very important influence on her work with the child analysis. And also Wilfred Bion. They worked together in the army, during the British Army, and he was also her second analyst. And his ideas were very important for the development of the ideas of Isabel Menzies in the functioning of the groups. But I guess the entire group of Tavistock at that time, they seems to have a very reciprocal influence. John Bowlby, John Rickman, Jack Sutherland, Elliot Jacks, and Donald Winnicott. I think it's a historical presentation, but I think it's important because she had a very important influence at the Tavistock, and as a social scientist and as a social and a psychoanalyst, she had influence in many areas, in the understanding the dynamics of the small groups, authority and leadership, the dynamic of the relationship between individuals, group, and organization. She had an important role on action research, on developing action research. And also, she is still quoted and used on social work, people from working on social work, is still important on child psychotherapy and also for the understanding of health and dynamic of hospitals. So the work I think showed the importance of psychoanalysis and at the Tavistock Institute on the 60s, on the 70s. And not only in England, but I think it's a work, the Tavistock work was impacted several countries, including Brazil. And we had here some important professors who took the ideas of the Tavistock for analyzing organizations here in Brazil, such as Sigmar Malvezzi, Araxi Martins Rodrigues, and Peter Spink. Brazilian professors that I think they were really important bringing the ideas of the Tavistock Institute to Brazil. So I think the main contributions of Isabel Menzies are two articles. The first one, The Function of Social Systems as Defense Against Anxiety, published in Human Relations in 1959, and where she discusses how the nurses could organize their work considering the anxiety that they face working with bodies, working with very tough situation, with death. So, and she showed how the work was organized to protect the workers from their anxiety. Even I, as a psychoanalyst, she showed how the elements of organizational life, structure, practices, policies, technologies, working methods, decision makings are impersonal, like elements that acquire a life of its own. Maybe it could be obvious to say this nowadays, but was not obvious at that time. And what not obvious, especially if you consider the psychoanalytic vision of how work and the groups are working. So I think, and all these elements also showed how this kind of organization of work could lead to a second level of consequences, such as resistance to change, so dissatisfaction, turnover, and things like that. So she was working with these topics at that time, and on the 60s, on the 70s, and I think they were very brilliant at that time. And I also want to quote another thinking about the psychoanalytic perspectives on social organization. I'm quoting. Isabel is amplified two defining features of what is often referred to as the Tavistock tradition. One is the emphasis on practicality, developing theory that's judged by its usefulness, which was formalized as action research methodology. And second, I was a commitment to the interdisciplinarity integration of different perspectives. She was a psychologist, a psychoanalyst, but she also was a very important social scientist. So her combination of an exceptional psychoanalyst and a social scientist. And also she worked as a formidable consultant in the Tavistock Institute. I think that her contributions are really impressive to understand the dynamic of groups in organization, but I think they were forgotten. I do not see the tests of Isabel Menzies that are continuing to be used in the business school discipline. I have two main hypotheses for that. First, I think from the 70s, from the 1975, on, she moved to Oxford and she worked more as a psychoanalyst than stay at the Tavistock Institute. But also, I think another reason maybe is because psychoanalysis has not the same importance nowadays than it has on the 60s, on the 70s. And this could be a very good discussion. Why psychoanalysis is not important anymore? There is a lot of things wrote about that. But I think she is still remembered and quoted on psychotherapy journals, on social work journals, on health journals. So, and there is a very, very good work from James Krantz, recovering the impact of Isabel Menzies' work in the 21st century. And this article is published in a journal of British psychotherapy, but not in a... And he discussed a lot about her importance on discussing organization, individuals and groups and organization, but it's not published in a journal on organizations on this area. So that's it. I don't know if I'm on my time, and thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you very much, Naria. Please join me in applauding. It's very interesting to see this variation in the way different communities, remember the work of some authors, right? And just a note, last year we had Cine Vichelso, who talked about the Tavistock, and that was recorded. And you can, you know, if you're curious to know more about the Tavistock, you can listen to that in our podcast. So next we are going to move to Lisa Cohen. I see she's here. And Lisa is an associate professor of organizational behavior at McGill Dessautels Faculty of Management. She's a leading voice in discussions related to job systems, careers, employment relations, and their connection with inequality patterns. She's also a firm believer in the importance of engaging and citing foundational work, not just the stuff written in the past 5 years. And Lisa will tell us today about the work of Rosabeth Moss-Kanter. Over to you, Lisa.
Thanks, Pedro. And thanks, Pedro and Greta, for putting me on this panel with so many unforgettable women. This has been great. My work has gotten better already just from listening to you. I'm last, I hope not least, I'm going to talk about Rosabeth Moss-Kanter. And I'll start by saying, I don't think there's any way we can say that she is forgotten. And I will talk about some of the ways that she is remembered as I go through my presentation. I made a decision because Rosabeth Moss-Kanter has done so much that there was no way I could cover everything. So I picked off a small piece that I'm going to focus on. So I will be very guilty of doing what I'm saying other people are doing, which is underappreciating her and not seeing the whole picture of her. I'll start with just some basic bibliographic things. She is a sociologist, and in fact, her first jobs were in sociology from the University of Michigan. She did a dissertation. I always find this fascinated on utopian communities. And some of these ideas, actually, you can see the strains of them going forward in all of her 20 books and the articles, cases, papers that she has written, too many for me to count in any way. I also want to point out some of the ways that she was a trailblazer. The OMT Distinguished Scholar Award started in 1980, and it wasn't until 1994 when she got it that a woman actually received that award. There have been maybe seven since, some of them actually presented in this panel, and maybe some of the panelists here or in the audience will someday receive that award. She was one of the first women faculty members at HBS, and actually this is sort of going to be closely related to the piece I talk about her. And people credit her with being the first woman business guru, which I don't know if that's damning her with faint praise or if it's real praise in this case. My focus, as I said, is on one accomplishment, the book Men and Women of the Corporation. And she's very clear. I've read interviews with her and talking about it's not men and women in the corporation, and it's not about people in the corporation. It's men and women of the corporation. This is a big accomplishment, and this is one of the reasons I can't say she's forgotten. Over 20,000 citations, I think in 2021 alone, there were over 400. So this isn't the same case as Rosemary Stewart. And in fact, in one of the retrospectives, these happen every 10 years or so of the book, of her work, Herminia Ibarra said, basically, it's impossible to discuss the status and experience of women without reference to men and women of the corporation. And just to check on that, I gathered a little of my own evidence here. And I went to an ASQ special virtual issue on gender that came out this March. I was a co-editor. And indeed, of the six articles, five of them look to this work. The central idea, the really big idea in this work, which may not sound so big to us today, but it was big at the time. The idea is that the social structure of organization determines our behavior and our experiences. And that there were three dimensions she talked about, the structure of opportunity, the structure of power, and the social composition of groups. So we're talking about things like proportions and tokens. And in fact, she's the one who really put the idea of tokenism into our academic language, right? She was one of the first people to talk about it. As I said, this may not seem big today, but at the time, right, there was this predominant psychological view that what happens to men and women is inherent to them, right? Maybe they're not good at math, and so they don't get the good jobs. Or there were some more macro perspectives, but they were very macro or focused on things like educational attainment. And she really focused on the interactional level, how people and structure interacted and what happened as a result of that. I want to put this graph up. My version, I would argue, is much prettier than her version. But this is basically the idea about proportions. I did a quick count and counted that there are about 10 men here. And at the time, because the numbers keep changing, that was about 25% of the group here. And what she says is this is a tilted group. With 25%, and that depending on which side you're on, you're a minority or a majority, and that will really shape your experience here. I also want to talk about the reach of her work because it's huge, right? I think there are so many bodies of research that have to talk about her. I mean, a lot of the work on gender and networks draws very heavily from her work on organizational demography, which is some of what I do. Organizational ethnographies, I think, owe a lot to this book and to what she did. She took culture very seriously. She feeds into social identity. I see all sorts of work on corporate boards that talks about tokens and loose change, and it becomes very important. So all of this in addition to just the pieces on diversity that she has influenced. I also want to make this a little personal. I think I've really appreciated the other panelists who did a little bit of this and talked about how their person had influenced them. And I feel like Rosa Beth Kanter has been along with me on my entire journey in my career. It started when I decided to get an MBA because I had no idea I was going to do this crazy PhD thing. But somebody gave me this book and said, you have to read this. It will help you to understand the experience you're going to have. And indeed it did. It also probably is what pushed me to go get a PhD. It was sort of, you know, as an MBA, you don't do a lot of reading of primary texts. And this was one that I read and pushed me to go forward. Her ideas on composition pushed me. One of my first academic papers, and then there were more, was eventually published in AJS. And then later it was included in a collection about Rosa Beth Moss Kanter, so it goes in both directions. I tried, and I found this fascinating, the first time I taught a PhD class, I tried to teach there's an article that goes with the books on the proportion piece. And I was fascinated because so many of the women in my class said it didn't describe their experience. And so that was interesting. I'd be curious to ask them now that they've been in the field for 10 years, if they still see this, because for me, it really does describe so much of my experience. And I think with that, I'm going to wrap up and say thank you for this.
We thank all our guest speakers for making this event a tremendous success, and the Academy of Management for allowing us to host the workshop.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberto Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.